for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Iran test fires two rounds of missiles, but stands accused of doctoring a photograph of one launch. Iraq's prime minister demands a timetable for withdrawal of U.S. troops. World leaders discuss global warming and Zimbabwe at the G8 meeting. And the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court seeks genocide charges against Sudan's president. Joining me for the Friday News Roundup, Moises Naim of Foreign Policy Magazine, Warren Strobel of McClatchy Newspapers, and Scott Wilson of The Washington Post. Please join us. Questions and comments, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Moises Naim, what do we make of Iran test firing these missiles? How do you read the Islamic Republic's intentions?
It is very hard to read because their governance structure is very fragmented. There are different power centers there. What we know is that they launched a series of Shahab 3 missiles that have a medium range that can strike Israel and Saudi Arabia and an important group of countries around Iran. So we don't know if this is just saber-rattling just before negotiations. The tests came after very good overtures on the part of diplomats, of Iranian diplomats, saying that they may be more willing to enter into negotiations concerning their nuclear program. And that opening created some optimism, only to be followed by the tests. So one way of interpreting it is that they're showing that what they have. So when they sit at the negotiating table, they're not treated as weak, a weak nation, but a nation that can do inflict a lot of damage negotiations don't go well.
And Scott Wilson, what do we make of the claims that the photographs were doctored?
Yeah, it was a real problem. The photos released by the Iranian state media organization apparently had some airbrushed additional missiles put in. One of the wire services moved those photos. It's hard to know what to make of that. There was also some claims that some other pictures that they released were not this particular missile launch, but past ones. It could be disorganization. It could be trying to show that they're doing more than they're actually doing. It's unclear. Just to follow up on what Moises said, also, you know, this round of missile testing follows Israel's very public aerial maneuvers over the Mediterranean last month. So in some ways, these two countries' enemies are talking to each other through these kinds of things. Here's
not
what we're doing.
Speaking very diplomatically,
not diplomatically,
I must say.
But also, I think, you know, when you keep in mind that oil prices are $140 a barrel, a major kind of confrontation between those two countries that would involve Persian Gulf Sunni countries would spike oil prices through the roof. So I think in some ways this is a sign that both sides do not really want to engage in any kind of a shooting war.
Do you agree with that, Warren? Are we closer or less close to a military confrontation?
I absolutely agree with what Scott said. I mean, I think we've seen a lot of shadow boxing going on here. The concern, though, is as you have Israel doing this exercise about a month ago where they apparently practiced a strike on Iran's nuclear facilities, you have what Iran's doing, you have tough words from Condi Rice that a miscalculation, even a small one in the Persian Gulf, could quickly degenerate. You know, the other thing that I thought was really interesting this week on Iran that didn't get as much attention as I think it should have, Undersecretary of State Bill Burns, who's the number three person at State and now the point guy on Iran, he testified before Capitol Hill and said Iran's progress on its nuclear program has been modest and not as much as they say. That tells me a couple things. It tells me the State Department's in charge of policy because I can't believe Dick Cheney's office would be happy with a statement of that kind. And also tells me that, you know, there's some time here to work this out in a diplomatic way.
One more thing that happened this week that didn't get enough attention is that Total, a French oil company, which was the last Western oil company operating in Iran, decided not to continue their investments in oil production in Iran. And that means that the sanctions, the European Union and the United States have imposed sanctions on Iran, also in to one of their largest banks. And that means that the sanctions are beginning to bite.
Moises Naim of Foreign Policy Magazine, Scott Wilson of The Washington Post, Warren Strobel of McClatchy Newspapers. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Condoleezza Rice was, in addition to making statements on Iran, was working toward a European missile defense shield this week. What kind of progress, Scott Wilson, is she making on this issue?
They did sign an agreement with the Czech Republic to begin deploying a missile defense shield in that country. They're still working with Poland to try to deploy one there. Getting back to our previous topic, they all became a piece. This morning, the Russian foreign minister, Russia very against the U.S. missile shield in Eastern Europe, said that the Iranian tests showed that there is no need for one. These are medium-range missiles. They are not intercontinental. There's no need for the United States, which it has said it is building this in part to prevent against an Iranian missile strike on U.S. soil or in Western Europe. And so they've all sort of come together. She did make some progress, but there's still huge resistance from the Russians, and they're using just about anything they can to say that this is not worthwhile.
So is the U.S. likely to move forward in any case, Warren?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there's also huge resistance from the Congress. I mean, I don't follow the sort of military procurement budget stuff that closely, but I believe Congress has severely curbed or delimited the funds for this program. So the Bush administration is sort of moving ahead on the diplomatic front of trying to put this in place while it's not clear the money's going to be there, at least anytime soon.
This program has been in place for about 10-12 years and costs billions of dollars. It started, it was generally called the Star Wars defense, and is the idea of creating a high-tech shield.
Right.
And it is highly controversial. It is very expensive.
And
it
they never got rid of it over the years.
And it's very controversial, and it has been very difficult to pinpoint and in fact, it has important performance problems. This is not a program that the vendors and the contractors and the Pentagon can be proud of.
But I heard someone on this program yesterday say that we have developed the technology to hit a bullet with a bullet from the ground.
I've been hearing that I covered Star Wars and what was known as Strategic Defense Initiative under the late Reagan administration. I've been hearing that for 25 years.
But you've never seen it.
I think they have made progress in terms of short-range missiles that are meant to attack troops. It's called tactical missile defense. There's been some success there. But in terms of the longer-range missiles, I don't think so.
Warren, what's the latest on negotiations between the U.S. and Iraq over a new security agreement?
Well, there's some really interesting developments this week on what's called the Status of Forces Agreement, or SOFA, the most important of which is the government of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is now saying they want troop withdrawal timeline of some kind, maybe 2010, 2011, 2012.
Why did he do this now?
Two reasons, I think. First of all, politics at home for Maliki. He's got elections coming up this fall, provincial elections, and the Sadrists, the allies of Muqtada al-Sadr, could do well, and they're campaigning on getting the American troops out now. So he's sort of protecting his flank there. The other thing I think is interesting is that it shows to me that the Maliki government must be somewhat more confident in itself, in the sense that a year ago, the Iraqis were terrified of the idea of the U.S. withdrawing. The Iraqi government, I mean, because they didn't feel they could handle the situation.
So they feel, or he feels, that militarily his own troops can take over?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, if you recall back to a few months ago when they pushed Iraqi troops into Basra in the south, the second largest city in Iraq, had a very rough first couple of weeks, but then have shown real progress since then on bringing that city and rooting out a lot of the Shiite militias that were controlling it. And since then, he's sort of had this steady drumbeat of confident statements, some of which have really antagonized the United States. The United States is very much against a fixed timeline on troop withdrawal. They think it only helps the insurgency, gives them a deadline. They can wait this out, watch for the troops to go. But Maliki is facing real internal Iraqi domestic political problems.
And Ali al-Adib, who is the chairman of the Dawa Party, that is Mr. Maliki's own party, said it well. He said, what happens is you have politics there and politics here. You have elections there, there meaning the United States, and elections here. And so there's a bit of pandering around this subject and about this subject in both places. And then there is a reality. There's a legal circumstance, and that is that the status of forces agreement is the legal entity, the legal document, the legal agreement that regulates the presence of troops, of the American troops there. And it can be very technical, but it's very important. The United States also now has a mandate from the Security Council that expires. And so that has to be replaced by this other kind of treaty or document. And it can be very technical, but it also raises the opportunity to deal with issues of sovereignty, of Iraq having become a sovereign nation that can impose conditions and that it has its own political process to account.
So it's a lot more complicated for the U.S. to negotiate this treaty than they thought it was going to be.
That's certainly proving to be true. And, you know, it should also be said that the Maliki government may be telling the Americans other things behind the scenes. Look, we're saying this publicly for reasons that are pretty obvious to you, having to do with Muqtada Sadr and his power, and telling them behind, don't worry about it, we're not going to really hold you to this as much as we're saying we are.
Scott Wilson of The Washington Post. Short break. We'll be right back. And we're back with the Friday News Roundup, this week with Scott Wilson of The Washington Post, Moises Naim of Foreign Policy Magazine, and Warren Strobel of McClatchy Newspapers. You are more than welcome to join us. Call us on 800-433-8850, or as Ben in Sheboygan, Pennsylvania did, send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Here is Ben's email. He says the chatter about a potential Iranian nuclear weapon seems to persist in great part for the diversion of talk show panelists and politicians. An Iranian atomic bomb will have meaning only if one, they use the bomb to destroy a city, or two, other nations truly believe they will use the bomb if threatened. If Iran makes an atomic bomb and immediately destroys Tel Aviv, they quickly would be incinerated by Israel with American help. Iran will not do that. Many nations have nuclear weapons, but there is little fear that any will be used. Iran will just be one more member of that club. Who cares?
That's a way of looking at it that is a guess. And if that guess is wrong, it can be a tragic mistake. Assuming that Iran is just another nation that will have this is a country, by the way, that, as we know, his president has said that, you know, one of the goals is the destruction of the state of Israel. As far as we know, no other country that has nuclear weapons has declared that their mission is to obliterate another country.
That's right. And as Moises pointed out earlier, Iran is a country, the government is extremely fractured between Shiite clerics, between, you know, populist politicians, each appealing to different constituencies. It's very hard to know on a day-to-day who's running that country. And, you know, Israel is a place that takes its security, you know, it is paramount. And it is made very, very clear that it will not let Iran have a nuclear weapon. So the point is well taken, but it's also the dynamics of these two countries in particular make this a different case than mutually assured destruction of Cold War times.
Interesting that the Wall Street Journal reported yesterday, Warren, that attacks in Iraq involving Iranian-made weapons have fallen sharply. Do we have any idea why?
Getting back to what Moises said at the very outset about the fractured nature of the Iranian government, we don't really know why. But I've been hearing this more and more, that there has been a sharp downtick in Iranian-sponsored attacks, Iranian military equipment coming across the border. Cynics will say it's just Iran can turn the faucet on and off as they want to sort of achieve their goals in Iraq. Other people think it goes back to what Scott was talking about earlier, the offensive in Basra, where the Maliki government, in cooperation with the U.S., really did put some of the Shiite militias and the Iranian-sponsored militias back on their heels.
You have a multitude of actors and players, each one sending different signals. And in Iran, and so you never know which one of the signals you're getting from the source that really has the power to do things, or is it just posturing, or is it just the result of haggling and negotiating between the different power centers in Iran.
And speaking of negotiating, Turkey and Iraq signed an agreement yesterday that includes border security. What can you tell us, Scott?
Only that it comes in a couple months after a pretty significant Turkish incursion into northern Iraq. It goes in to root out Kurdish guerrillas who use Kurdish Iraq to stage attacks inside Turkey. Maliki is behind the agreement, but of course it would have to pass muster as well and be supported on the ground by the autonomous Kurdish regional authority that has control of most of that border.
And that's very important, what Scott just said. And it also highlights the importance of the visit of Prime Minister Erdogan to Turkey, which is the first time that a Turkish leader, Turkish Prime Minister, visits Iraq in 18 years. And that comes at a time in which there's a flurry of appointments of ambassadors from neighboring countries to Iraq. Remember that for a long time, for many years, the neighborhood just ignored and decided, this is an American problem, let them deal with it. And they did not appoint ambassadors, they did not engage in a significant way, and so on. In the last week or so, Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait announced that they are deploying ambassadors for the first time after the invasion to Baghdad. And that means that there is a growing international engagement with Iraq and with the Iraqi government, and that bodes well. I think that's what we have always hoped that it was not going just to be an American problem, but that it's going, that Iraq was becoming a more normal country, even if in the way it deals with all the, and is inserted in the international community in the region.
I think that's absolutely right. I can't tell you how many trips I've been on with Secretary Rice to the Middle East over the last year and a half, too, where she's basically had to beg the Arab leaders to send ambassadors to Iraq, and now that's starting to happen. But the big country that's still sort of out of that is Saudi Arabia. And when Saudi Arabia sends an ambassador, Saudi Arabia
What's
being
the
leading Sunni...
What's the hold back?
They're the leading Sunni state in their eyes and the eyes of much of the world, and they still, a lot of people in Saudi Arabia, the leadership sees the Maliki government as a front, a Shiite front that'll eventually bring the Shiites in them throughout the region. Not to put too fine a point on it.
All right. Let's turn to the International Criminal Court, which may charge Sudan's president with crimes against humanity. What could that mean, Scott?
Well, it's what we what is being reported now is that the ICC prosecutor Luis Moreno Ocampo in Argentina is going to be seeking an arrest warrant and filing charges on Monday against the Sudanese president, Omar Hassan al-Bashir. What it means is, first, there will be a process, an evaluative process on the evidence that he presents to a three-judge panel. Those judges will then say, yes, proceed with an arrest warrant. We will be charging him with genocide. What it means practically on the ground, forces will not be going into Khartoum to arrest the president, but it does will limit his ability to travel significantly.
I see.
And undermines his legitimacy in the eyes of the world to the degree that, that international law is now being asserted against
and
him.
And in the meantime, you had seven peacekeepers killed this week by, apparently by militia men.
Yes, and the situation is getting out of hand, even more out of hand, and some of the peacekeepers are just saying that it has never been as bad as it is now.
Right.
And in fact, one of the concerns is that as a result of these trying to seek the arrest or a warrant against President Hassan al-Bashir, they will react in a very violent way and will escalate the violence and make the job of peacekeeper and aid workers far more complicated and dangerous.
We've heard more this week about the dramatic rescue of those hostages in Colombia, including Ms. Betancourt, who ran for president and was kidnapped while she was running. There's been a lot of talk that the FARC is weakening, that Ingrid Betancourt says she won't cut her hair until hundreds of other hostages are released. Now, here's an email from Mary in Seattle who says, I have a queasy feeling about the rescue in Colombia of FARC-held hostages, including American contractors, which may be entirely a good thing. But what I wonder about was whether Senator McCain was in on that. Is it unremarkable for one party's nominee for president to get a campaign boost from a foreign government's covert action? Did he get a campaign boost?
What we were told by the White House, and I think the McCain campaign, and perhaps even the Colombian government, he was there at the time, or just, I forget, maybe he had just left when the rescue happened. He was briefed, I believe, by the Colombian government that this was about to take place, but this sort of thing is so complicated. It had been worked on for months and months by the Colombian intelligence and special forces agencies with help from the U.S. There's just no way, I think, you could try and pull this off just to coincide with a McCain visit.
Yeah, we had a pretty interesting account from our correspondent in Bogota that sort of detailed the trail and how long that the actual group of that the FARC front that was holding these hostages, that they were following them, U.S. Special Forces and Colombian Special Forces together through the jungle. And at certain times over the last 4 months, got as close to see them bathing in rivers and you know, just a remarkable amount of scrutiny being paid. So Senator McCain was there on a good day for him, but it most likely had absolutely nothing to do with the rescue.
The main protagonist of this heroic rescue is the Colombian government and the Colombian military, who were able to extract these hostages without shooting, without firing anything.
Do you think she'll run again for president?
I think she has to go through a very complicated process that we are now beginning to witness. She was for 6 years essentially in chains in the middle of the jungle, and she just just left, and a few hours later she was with Sarkozy. And there should be a process in which she regains
just
her.
Just unfold.
It is very complicated. Mm-hmm. She must have some post-traumatic stress disorder of some kind. It is very difficult. What is important about this, and the main, an important story, is not about Mr. McCain, but about President Chavez from Venezuela. Remember that President Chavez tried very hard to be the one that would be the liberator of Ingrid Betancourt and the other hostages. And that didn't work out. He failed. And then he started insulting and telling the world that Mr. Uribe was a criminal, that he was a liar, that never again in his life Mr. Chavez was going to have any kinds of deals with Mr. Uribe. Well, Mr. Uribe was invited by Mr. Chavez and his kind this weekend to Caracas to enter into talks. And Chavez now calls Mr. Uribe his brother.
Well, and Ingrid Betancourt praised Mr. Uribe because apparently he had knowledge of what was about to happen, Scott.
Yeah, absolutely. And she was taken when she was running against Mr. Uribe for president, taken at a FARC roadblock down in an area that the government had turned over to the FARC at the time and was in the process of taking back. But she's also called, though, for a broader regional engagement of the FARC, less criticism. She invites Chavez to play a role, although some of the documents that turned up on some of these FARC computers recently show that when Chavez got involved as a mediator not long ago, there was an uptick in the hostage crisis. There was an uptick in activity surrounding arms trading with the FARC and money exchange.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. The question becomes whether President Uribe himself might run for a third term in office, but wouldn't that require a constitutional change?
Yeah, I believe it would require a constitutional change. To me, the bigger story here is, Diane, is the what's happened to the FARC. I mean, it's easy to overstate or overestimate this, but this is an organization that was a state within a state that was growing in power, that had power to challenge the state. And now it's people are defecting. They don't have regular radio communications with one another. It just seems like it's collapsing. It's quite fascinating. It's something you don't really see all that often.
It is. It's remarkable. I mean, their sort of paramount leader, who was an old man, died in the recent months. I was in Colombia in the early 2000s, and it was the FARC had 18,000 people under arms. We couldn't leave the capital on most roads. It controlled by government sanction this giant portion of southern Colombia, and that has completely changed. 8,000 people is now the high-end estimate on the number of people they have in arms. This rescue was carried out by pretending to be the new leader of the FARC, Alfonso Cano. And it just suggests that there is no command and control taking place right now between really what was probably the most important front in the FARC, that holding these very valuable hostages which they intended to trade for hundreds of FARC prisoners.
So what does this mean for the future as far as release of the other prisoners?
We don't know, and it's one of the concerns is that the FARC are very cruel and very primitive in a way, and it may be that one of the reactions to this embarrassment is to heighten their cruelty and take it out on the remaining hostages. But it is true that the FARC has been deeply weakened. It continues to be an important force, but it's in decline. And not surprisingly, President Uribe's popularity ratings are at an all-time high in Colombia. He's the most popular president, and he's also has the highest popularity in the hemisphere.
Interesting. And speaking of the hemisphere, the world's major industrialized nations met in Japan this week. What did the G8 accomplish, Scott?
Well, the main headlines had to do with the greenhouse gas emissions. There was a consensus to halve greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. The Bush administration, for the first time signed on to this proposal. Last year, they had said that they would just consider something like this. At the same time, almost at once, we're seeing in news stories today that the Bush administration does not intend to impose any new regulations on greenhouse gas emissions by the time it leaves office. May not be that surprising. There's only a few months left. But nonetheless, there is a sense that there are statements being made on an issue of increasing global interest in public. Very little action to back it up. That was the main headline.
Warren.
Yeah, I think the environmental groups were quite critical of this, and probably rightly so. It's a promise to take actions to reduce greenhouse gases by half, but, promises are... Plus, I mean, the excellent story in the Washington Post this morning about the EPA is not going to do anything for the rest of the Bush administration. I sort of thought the whole G8 meetings to begin with are somewhat amorphous, but this one more than most. Perhaps it's because President Bush's term is coming to an end. Perhaps it's because of the nature of world problems, but it just didn't seem to generate a lot of serious action on important issues.
How did you read George Bush's farewell? He said, "Goodbye from the world's biggest polluter," and then punched the air while he was grinning.
Well,
and you haven't got time to respond, Moises. I just want to make sure we got that final comment on. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Miriam Muscarolis and Grant Abramson, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by AMARC Foundation, supporting procon.org, with the 2008 presidential candidates' positions on many issues at procon.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
My eyes are so bleary. I guess I'm young, but I feel so weary.
On the next Fresh Air, actress and singer Zoe Deschanel. Her band, She and Him, with indie rock musician M. Ward, starts its summer tour later this month. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
A very part of me speaks slowly. I can't hear you. My mind keeps spinning closer.
And now to your comments for this week's Friday News Roundup. Our guests in the studio, Warren Strobel of McClatchy Newspapers, Scott Wilson of The Washington Post, Moises Naim of Foreign Policy Magazine. First to Vineyard Haven, Massachusetts. Good morning, Toby. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for answering my call.
Sure.
I wonder if your panel would like to comment on the irony of the Iraqi government asking for a troop withdrawal time date when this has been going on in our country now for over 3 years. And if I can just throw my 2 cents in on the McCain visit to Colombia, the fact that Charles Black was with him, and that Charles Black is one of the biggest lobbyists for the government of Colombia in Washington. Thank you for taking my call.
All right.
I'll listen to you online.
Thanks for calling. Moises, I think that her question goes right to that from Paul in Oklahoma City, who says, didn't Bush say we'd honor Iraq's request to leave when they wanted us to? This statement goes back some time, but now we're mad they want us out. What's up with that?
And I think President Bush repeated that statement just this week or very recently, saying that Iraq now is a sovereign country. And as such, Iraq has the right to define the terms and negotiate the terms of the Status of Forces Agreement, as we discussed it before, is the document, the treaty that defines the ways in which the United States troops and personnel operate in the country.
Here's another email from Orient, New York. Donald says, at the outset of the Iraq War, the administration told us the war would be financed by the proceeds from the sale of Iraqi oil. Is any of this money being used to help fund the war? I've listened carefully. I hear nothing from any source on this subject, Warren.
Well, what's happened in the last couple of years is that the administration has pushed the Iraqis to finance more of the war themselves, of their own defense, and that money obviously would be drawn from Iraqi oil proceeds. But as we all know, the oil hasn't paid certainly for our costs or anything like it.
All right, let's go to Daniel in Mooresville, North Carolina. Good morning to you.
Hi, Diane. Good morning, and thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
My question is in regard to Zimbabwe, the president of Zimbabwe, Mugabe. I don't understand why, up until now, the international community has not issued an arrest warrant on him for crimes against humanity. And my understanding is there has been a documented fact about what his regime does in targeting opposition, people that have been maimed, killed, and nothing is being done on this. And why is it that the international community is hesitating in doing so? And my next question is South Africa the only country that has the power to negotiate between Mugabe's party and that of the opposition?
Thank you.
An important reporting piece this week from one of Scott Wilson's reporter there, Craig Timberg. He wrote and documented an extraordinary set of issues concerning Zimbabwe and Mugabe, essentially showing that all the attention placed on Mugabe distracted us from the fact that he's just, in many ways, just a puppet. That there are very important, powerful actors in the military, especially in the military, the intelligence services, and other groups in the country that are calling the shots. And that, in fact, at some point, Mr. Mugabe met with them and said, I'm leaving. We lost the election and the opposition won, and let's go. And the military said, well, no, you're not going anywhere. You have to stay, and if you don't want to stay, we're going to take over and do, you know, it's going to be a tank in the streets kind of coup. Or you stay and we'll take care of the opposition. And they developed a brutal, horrible plan of assassination and brutalization.
How in the world, Scott, did he manage to get that story?
Well, in large part, he got it with the help of a very, very brave Zimbabwean journalist.
Wow.
Who works with Craig there, who was not named in the story. We had a line in the story about why we could not name him, but the large role that he played in helping us. What he saw, essentially, were minutes from meetings that took place between the first round of elections at the end of March and the runoff election at the end of June. And the conversations that were taking place inside these the security among security officials and Mugabe, and the plan that was developed that went by the acronym of coercion, intimidation, beating, and displacement, CIDB.
So what happens to Tsvangirai, Morgan Tsvangirai, in the midst of all of this negotiation or note writing?
Well, his name did not come up specifically in this, but it was aimed very much at the grassroots of his organization. And by the end, more than 80 opposition activists were killed, thousands were jailed, displacement in places where Tsvangirai was strongest had cleared out whole areas of people and created an internal refugee problem. And Tsvangirai, of course, was prompted at the end to drop out of the race and seek refuge actually in a foreign embassy. So the plan to that degree was quite successful. But of course, there's very little legitimacy now attached to this this victory.
All right, two questions. Back to Daniel's specific question: will Mugabe be charged with crimes against humanity? Second question: will Morgan Tsvangirai move into some kind of negotiation for sharing of power? Warren.
Man, this is a tough, tough problem.
I know.
Do you send in American troops or international troops to oust Mugabe? I don't think there's much appetite for that. The administration, the U.S. and outside world strategy has been to let the African leaders, especially South Africa, deal with this.
Has South Africa stepped up to the plate?
There's
Doesn't
a lot of criticism
that, way.
That they actually have not stepped up to the plate, and that they have not, you know, they're trying to encourage power-sharing negotiations, but there's a lot of people who believe that, you know, what kind of power-sharing negotiations are warranted at this point?
Daniel.
And then the third... Just real quickly, the third venue is the UN Security Council and sanctions, but it's United States has introduced a resolution for sanctions, but it's unclear whether China and Russia, who have this allergy to sanctions, are going to go along with that. And that's a long-term process in any event. So it's a tough, tough problem.
What happens to this reporter now? Is he moving off this story?
On the eve that we published the story, he and his family left their home moved someplace else in the country. I don't want to say too much about it.
I understand.
Moved someplace else in the country and kept in very close touch with Craig, and we kept in touch with Craig. He had left the country the day before we published the story himself, and that's why we were able to actually use his name on the story. We had been withholding his name while he was working inside the country.
Wow.
But our understanding right now, and we're in still daily touch with this reporter in Zimbabwe, that he is fine.
Well, our thanks to him for doing that kind of reporting and bringing that information out to the public. Let's now go to Nashville, Tennessee. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning, Diane. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you, sir.
Okay. I hate to be cynical, but as reporters, your panelists, I'm sure you've heard probably the most fantastical webs of wickedness on by the best conspiracy theorists, but earlier in the show, you just all of you found it, you know, hard to believe that John McCain's visit to Colombia was anything but a coincidence. And I think the timing of it was more than that, because I think both panelists said that it was planned, you know, months in advance. I think McCain's visit was planned after that, so it wouldn't be hard for me to believe in this political presidential season that the Bush administration, with a nod and a wink, could just simply say that you might want to plan a visit to Colombia under the guise of promoting free trade. At this particular time, it could prove some political benefit for you because we have this plan to, you know, rescue these hostages. I know you used to be a hostage, Mr. McCain. I know you want to promote your foreign policy credentials and to boost your reputation among the American people that you have connections with throughout the world. And just, this might be a good time to go there.
All right, Tony. The question is, did McCain get a political boost from having been there? Seems to me that there were downsides as well. There are an awful lot of people without jobs who are blaming free trade and a trade deal with Colombia on, blaming McCain for taking this position, Scott.
I agree with you, Diane. I just didn't see much of a political boost to McCain's visit whatsoever. And I can say that according to our correspondent there who wrote this in a story, that the White House was briefed on this operation June 30th, 2 days before it was to take place. And John McCain's visit to Colombia was planned well in advance of that.
Did you know that John McCain's visit to Colombia was planned well in advance? Or did the campaign simply say that?
Our national staff was planning to accompany John McCain on this visit well in advance of that June
30th briefing. Fine. I think that that's an important fact. Let's go now to Brunswick, Maryland. Ellis, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I think that the, in my opinion, the reason that the Bush administration is whipping up the anxiety and fear against Iran is directly related to the November election, because Republicans have nothing to run on except fear. They've exploited fear since September 11th. They certainly cannot run on their contemptible record. That's all they have left is fear. And Condoleezza Rice's comments about defense against Iran are absurd. She's turning words and logic on their head when talking about the need to defend against Iran.
Moises.
Well, I don't know about that, and I always want to be careful in ascribing motives to people. There is no doubt that Iran's statements and Iran's behavior warrant a lot of concern on the part of the United States. And it's not just the United States. The European Union also felt that it was warranted to impose tougher sanctions in Iran. So there is something going on there that is beyond. Not everything that happens in the world is related to the U.S. election.
We hope. We hope. At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go now to Kalamazoo, Michigan. Hi there, Rebecca. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Morning.
I have a question about the payment for Iraq's reconstruction coming from Iraq's oil. I believe that according to the Geneva Conventions, invading a country for their natural resources is illegal. Okay, the administration says we didn't do that. But to expect a country to pay for its own reconstruction, no. We are on the hook for those reparations, just like Saddam was to Kuwait in the 90s after his invasion. It is our unfortunate responsibility to put that country back together.
Thanks for calling, Warren.
Well, the truth is, Rebecca, we have paid billions and billions of dollars to help reconstruct Iraq.
But how far has that gone?
Well, that's the good question. And so billions and billions of it has gone to security. Lots of it has been wasted, as GAO reports and Defense Department Inspector General reports have shown. But to say that we haven't at least attempted to spend a lot of money in Iraq is not correct.
The original assumptions about this overestimated the capacity of Iraq to get a very important flow of funds as a result of oil exports, and underestimated the devastation of Iraq's infrastructure unrelated to the war. The sanctions and Saddam Hussein's decades of misgoverning the country, it just created a situation where it was very, very hard to get the country moving, and a lot of the money has to go to just repair the damages of decades of Saddam Hussein's.
Here's an email from Chad in St. Louis, Missouri. What's the precise benefit to the U.S. to defending or going to war for Israel? The cost is clear. I think a war with Iran could bring on the demise of our nation. We are teetering on the brink of bankruptcy. Our military is stretched so thin, we are actually losing our ability to defend ourselves. Would we be better served by pulling back from so much involvement in the Middle East? Scott.
I think the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said that just this week in testimony before Congress that a war with Iran would be greatly stressing to the U.S. military. Defending Israel in a war against Iran has many components, moral and strategic. But there is no question that more fighting in the Middle East is something that I believe most likely many people in the uniform military feel would be a huge strain on the armed forces right now.
And this is happening at the same week that the casualties in Afghanistan are soaring. So while violence in Iraq is declining, violence and casualties, American casualties and violence and the whole situation in Afghanistan is deteriorating, and there are strong appeals and strong requests for more military involvement by the United States in Afghanistan.
Warren.
Two quick points. Zbigniew Brzezinski, the former National Security Advisor, would agree with Chad. He wrote some months ago that a U.S. military attack on Iran would be the last fatal mistake for this country. And secondly, just to step back a bit, what's interesting to me about the U.S.-Iranian confrontation is you have two divided governments facing off against each other. The Bush administration is completely divided about what to do, and as we've discussed, the Iranian government is also divided about its goals.
Warren Strobel of McClatchy, Scott Wilson of The Washington Post, Moises Naim of Foreign Policy Magazine, thank you all. I'll be off for a few days next week. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg, with help from Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from Softscribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.